going to tell you about a continuation of an old story. It's basically been a differential equation that's puzzled me for many years, but it does have some aspects that fit into the topic of this meeting. So the recent work will be in a paper that will come out shortly with Hong Liu, Chris Pope, and Alan Perkins. So let me just situate it a little bit, the quantum context, which is the topic of most of this meeting. When you take into account one-loop corrections to general relativity in four-dimensional space-time, you get ultraviolet divergences that involve curvature squared. And if we include those, so my game is going to basically to include those terms, the vial squared and r squared terms, into the gravitational action ab initio and take them seriously. When you do that, you obtain a renormalizable theory in four dimensions at the price ostensibly of a loss of unitarity coming from the modes given rise to by the vial squared term. You can also trade in vial squared for the combination r mu nu squared minus a third r squared using the Gauss-Bonnet theorem. And that will typically be the way that I approach this later on. Now, there are a couple of contexts, as we've just been hearing, in which these quadratic curvature theories have been discussed recently. One we just heard from Alfio, the r plus r squared theory, which up until a couple of weeks ago was the leading contender. One thing I want to take from this, however, will be the notion of scale. In order for the Starobinsky model to work, the corresponding mass, there will be a scalar particle that we'll see in a moment, should have a mass of on the order of 10 to the minus 6 of the Planck mass. So that gives you an idea of the size of these coefficients, which is not small. So in particular, I want to take a point of view that we take these seriously in the action, and we don't just treat them as a small perturbation around Einstein theory. The other point of view, of course, is the asymptotic safety scenario. And in particular, I might focus on the work of Niedermeyer, who takes into account, takes the asymptotic safety point of view, starting with the renormalizable r plus vial squared plus r squared theory, considers asymptotic safety within that framework, and in particular makes a claim that there is A, a non-Gaussian fixed point, and B, that there are flow trajectories coming out of that fixed point along which ghost states arising from the vial squared term are absent. So here is a graphic that I stole from Niedermeyer's paper showing renormalization group trajectories in coupling constant space ending on a non-Gaussian fixed point with finite Newton's constant and cosmological constant. The key point from my point of view here would be that he claims that there are trajectories on which the Hessian matrix of second derivatives, which gives rise to the residues of the effective theory propagator, is never negative. I don't want to get involved in detailed discussions of asymptotic safety here. I merely want to use this as motivation for the rest of my talk, which is to take these vial squared and r squared terms seriously in the gravitational action. So the rest of the talk is actually going to be conducted at a classical level, but I'm going to take these, I'm going to call it r mu nu, and r squared terms seriously in the gravitational action, and I want to see what this does to the most famous solution of relativity, of course, which is the spherically symmetric static solution. And the field equations that we're confronting now are here with the higher fourth order terms. And of course, the bottom line is the ordinary terms of Einstein theory, in principle equal to a stress tensor, which I'll come back to. We have to consider the proper coupling to the rest of the world as well. For a lot of the time, I'll set zero on the right-hand side here, but we also have to consider what happens when you couple, for example, via minimal coupling to other matter. And I would remind you that the renormalizable theory consists of the r squared, vial squared, and r terms, plus an ordinarily renormalizable theory such as the standard model. Right? So that is the context in which minimal coupling via promotion of partial derivatives to covariant derivatives proceeds. So what can we say about the dynamics of this theory? It's complicated. So one technique is to look at weak fields and linearize, or look at the quadratic action here, where if we split the metric into a flat part and h mu nu, at the quadratic level in the actions expanded around flat space, we have this structure where we have a spin 2 and a spin 0 projector, and you see that there are fourth order terms here, as well as second order terms from the Einstein-Hilbert action. Here are the projectors into the spin 2 and spin 0 sectors. And in this approximation, the indices are raised and lowered with respect to the background flat metric. So taking that as our action, we then analyze the spectrum, and we see that there is a massive spin 2 and a massive spin 0 mode to the theory. The massive spin 0 mode is positive energy, and so there's no issue of stability with respect to it. But massive spin 2 has a negative kinetic term, and therefore this is the potentially disastrous ghost. Now, in order to explain how that came about, let's just consider a simpler model here of just a scalar field where I've included an ordinary second derivative kinetic term with the usual, I'm an East Coast American, so there's a minus sign is my sign for the kinetic term. And I will include also a fourth order term here and couple also to some hypothetical source, J. If we go over into momentum space, you can solve for phi and then separate the propagator. You get a 1 over k to the fourth type action, of course, because it's a fourth order theory. But you can separate this into partial fractions. And you see an ordinary massless propagator for a massless spin 0 and a massive propagator, but with a relative minus sign, which is unavoidable. So that's the issue of the ghost. So that's similar to the structure found in quadratic gravity, but without the spin complications. Okay, so we're going to take this theory seriously with its fourth-order action, and now try to see what we can say about the gravity theory. So let me work in a metric, which is given here, a standard Schwarzschild-type parameterization for a spherically symmetric static solution, and that's going to be all I really can talk about here. And if
so
we...
Just, yeah.
No, do not.
This
is because I want to look at, right? Because you see the equations are horrible. I do what I can, okay? So at the linearized level, I can analyze this system, and we find a solution that depends upon 6 integration constants for the A, that's the space-space, and B, that's the time-time components of the metric, given here with the various 6 integration constants, of course, being involved. You see that there are 1 over r terms, Newtonian type 1 over r terms, and you have Yukawa terms, which of course are natural given the presence of the spin 2 and spin 0 fields. Okay, so now if I remember that I should be coupling also to the rest of the world, if we go back and include also an h mu nu t mu nu term into the action with a minimal coupling, with a standard stress tensor. I'm just going to take a toy model here of a delta function source at the origin. If I took an extended source, for example, a kid's balloon with some ideal gas in the middle constrained by an elastic membrane, then this question about Birkhoff's theorem comes back, and you'll find a different distribution of the coefficients here. So what I've given here are the relations between the m of my source mass and the various 1 over r terms and the Yukawa terms here. You see they depend upon the mass, and they will also depend upon the structure of the source if I give an extended source, because there is no Birkhoff's theorem in this theory. So you want to know how I do the calculation with the delta function? Well, this is just by straightforward transform methods, right? Transform into momentum space and solve. Or I can take an extended eggshell source, which you wish, and then you can use Israel matching conditions. You go across the shell. There are various ways to get this result. But this is just a linearized theory, so I can solve this one. Okay? The nonlinear theory, that's my topic to try to come on to this, right? I'm telling you what happens at the linearized theory. And of course, in a weak field approximation, you go out far near infinity, you should trust this. Gives you some aspect of the solutions of the theory. I have, of course, excluded the rising Yukawa potentials here because I'm trying to talk about a solution near flat space. So I've imposed asymptotic boundary conditions at infinity to get rid of the rising Yukawas, but we expect to see these falling Yukawa terms from the spin 2 and spin 0 modes. Well, what about Schwarzschild itself? If you go back to the original full higher derivative field equations, that I called h mu nu, now with no source on the right-hand side, just study that, you see that r mu nu equals, it involves all sorts of covariant derivatives and products. Every term involves a Ricci tensor. So if r mu nu is equal to zero, you automatically solve the higher derivative equations, and you get one known solution, which is good old Schwarzschild. The solution space of this theory, however, is more complicated, as, again, one can see by going back to the simple toy model. Here, as well, we have box minus m squared on box phi equals zero, and of course, any solution of box phi equals zero solves the higher derivative equations. There will be other solutions, as we saw from the Yukawa terms, but in particular, there is a pure 1 over r type of solution here to the this model theory. Now, the question is, however, whether this is the solution that you want if you're making ordinary minimal coupling, okay? The solution in the static case is of the ordinary 1 over r solution is del squared phi equals q times a delta function. We know how to do that. Now, is that the solution we actually want in this theory? Well, if you want this 1 over r solution, what you're going to have to put on the right-hand side is not a delta function, but you're going to have to put this, del squared minus m squared times a delta function, which is a rather nasty distribution. It's not even positive if you multiply it by a test function. So if you want the 1 over r solution, you're talking about a coupling with rather unusual and not necessarily positive couplings to the rest of the world. Okay? Whereas if you couple to the 1 over r, if you couple to standard stress tensor, what you're going to get is a combination of the 1 over r and the Yukawas. So that's one of my basic points here. So we can conclude that although the Schwarzschild solution will be a solution of the homogeneous equations with h mu nu equals zero without taking account of coupling, when you do take into account coupling, this Schwarzschild solution will not be the one that arises from natural minimal coupling. Okay, now let's consider the full nonlinear field equations, again for the source-free spherically symmetric case. They are not particularly nice to look at. Here's one of them. They have been reorganized in such a way that the worst derivative is the third order. Generally, you get a third and a fourth order equation, but you can take the third order equation, differentiate it, multiply it, subtract it from the fourth order equation, and get a much better system with two third order differential equations. This is one of them. You can see the third derivative down here. And here's the other, where somewhere down there you can see the third derivative of the other field. So this is the task for the graduate student to go and find an exact solution of this. And it's a little bit tough. So really, this is just show and tell. We want to see what is the character of the solutions to this spherically symmetric static solution. Well, the more recent work on this uses an Israel theorem, which exists in this higher derivative theory. So this is going to be the content of our paper to come out. And it uses a paper by a guy named William Nelson, who's currently at Penn State. That paper needs some correction in order to use properly, but we've done that. And basically, I'm going to use this as a kind of a tool to understand the link between what happens at infinity and what happens at the origin in the family of solutions that I'm concerned with. This is a no-hair type of theorem. It's a classic Israel Lichnerowitz type of theorem, but it applies to the quadratic curvature gravity theory. The standard approach is to write down the field equations, dream up some appropriate tensorial factor to multiply into the field equations, and then integrate out from an assumed horizon to infinity, and try to get a system where you have sums of squares all of the same sign. You have to worry about boundary terms. Of course, at infinity, we'll be assuming asymptotic flatness. And if you assume a horizon, that will be the inner boundary. OK, so here is a flavor of what happens here. Of course, we have these spin 0 and spin 2 masses. I want both of them to be non-tachyonic, so their squares will be greater than 0. In this case, I'm going to tell you about the spin 0 part. If you take the trace of the field equation, it boils down to something much nicer looking, which is just it's a Klein-Gordon equation acting on the Ricci scalar R, which is naturally the interpolating field for the scalar massive mode. If you multiply this by R times lambda to the 1/2, where lambda is the norm of the time-like killing vector orthogonal to the spatial slice, okay? So you multiply by lambda to the 1/2 R and integrate over the spatial slice at a fixed time, from an inner boundary to an outer boundary. integrating by parts, which means taking account of this total covariant derivative term here, we obtain two terms, you see, that involve squares and are of the same sign. So as long as I'm not upset by this term here, I'm going to learn that r equals 0. So I've already learned quite a lot about the solutions of this theory, subject to the assumption that I'm not worried by the boundaries. Okay, so subject to those assumptions, and for non-tachyonic m0 squared, you obtain r equals 0. The inner boundary will give a 0 contribution since lambda, the norm of the time-like Killing vector, is 0 there. The outer boundary, I'm going to assume asymptotic flatness. Okay, then you have to go on to the non-trace parts. These are more complicated to deal with, but you follow a similar procedure. You multiply and you obtain a surface term, vanishes on a null surface and an asymptotically flat spatial infinity. You obtain, again, a sum of squares of the same negative sign, plus two final terms that will also be of the same sign, providing certain inequalities are obeyed, and I've given them here. So these involve now the spin 2 mass. I can make this large by making the spin 2 mass, remember, is the inverse of the coefficient of the Weyl squared term. So if I make that small, the spin 2 mass is large. So in the limit as m2 goes to infinity, these two inequalities become trivial to be satisfied. But maybe with a view to things I want to comment on later on, you can ask how large is relevant for m2, and I'll come back to that in comments at the end. Subject to these assumptions that these inequalities are satisfied, you obtain again that the pullback of the four-dimensional Ricci tensor to the three-dimensional slice is 0, and the three Ricci scalar is 0. Put those together and you obtain the full r mu nu equals 0, i.e., you've concluded that the solution must be just Schwarzschild. Now, what I want to do is to use this as a logical tool to show you that since the proper coupling to stress tensor solutions will have Yukawa corrections, at least in the weak field approximation, something in this theorem must be violated. And the only thing that can be violated is the key assumption. I want to talk about asymptotically flat solutions. The other is the horizon. You're forced into the conclusion that these solutions, the extra solution family of this theory that has Yukawa-like corrections, cannot have a horizon. So that's the implication of the Israel theorem, that the spherically symmetric static solution that has Yukawa corrections cannot have a horizon. And this will be the family that can couple by minimal coupling to the rest of the theory. No, I merely didn't want to talk about the details because it's more complicated and I only have half an hour. But no, I'm not excluding anything.
In that case, any metric in the conformal class is working. It's still a solution, right?
It's not a conformally invariant theory. There's an R term in the action. The Einstein term is present in the action. Yeah, okay. No, that's important because otherwise I'd have pure fourth order, 1 over k to the fourth type propagators, and then we need a longer discussion. Okay, I can discuss that too. There's another type of ghost you get with linear term, but anyway, discuss that over coffee. Okay, so the conclusion has to be that one of the assumptions of the Noether theorem is violated, and the only relevant assumption is that there is a horizon. So we are looking at solutions with no horizon. Black holes are not so black. So now the question is, what can the near origin structure of these solutions actually be? Well, we can go and do a different type of analysis. A place where the normal is zero length. The norm of apparent horizon, okay. I'm not worried about global issues. So let's go look at near the origin now and perform an asymptotic expansion in a Laurent series with some unknown powers S and T for the space and time parts of the metric, and put them into the full nonlinear field equations and study this as R goes to 0. You find three possible families of behavior and with varying numbers of parameters. Actually, in my old 1978 paper, I was not strong enough to do all of this because I was doing it by hand. Of course, now with Mathematica, you find that some of these parameters show up at crazy high orders like sixth order, and I was not able to do that. We now know the distribution. There's a S and T are these powers. 1 minus 1, that's of course where the ordinary Schwarzschild family lives. 0, 0. Oh, there's a nice non-singular family, actually, of this this theory, with three free parameters, and 2, 2, going like radius squared in both space-space and time-time components with six parameters. Now, the Israel theorem is very useful here because you can use it to shoot two of these families, exclude them from the category of solutions that have the Yukawa corrections. We know there's no horizon, as I've told you, but also you can use the Israel theorem even if you are not concerned about the issue of a horizon. In this case, the 0-0 family, you just look at whether you can get rid of that nasty integration by parts total derivative term. And in this 0-0 family, you can use the Israel theorem going all the way down to the origin. It's still good. You could conclude in that case that the solution has to be Schwarzschild. Clearly, it's not Schwarzschild because that is not the behavior of the Schwarzschild solution. So there's no horizon in this family. But the other thing that goes wrong, of course, is the other assumption. It goes up at infinity. So this is not the family of solutions I'm looking for. 1 minus 1 does contain Schwarzschild. That has a horizon, and I can use the Israel theorem in that case, again, to show that the non-Schwarzschildality parameter, when you tune it, of course, must cause something to be violated in the assumptions of the Israel theorem. Again, it's asymptotic flatness. So the solutions we're looking for don't live in these two families. The remaining family, which is not eligible for treatment by the Israel theorem, because you get a singularity at the origin, and if we're assuming there's no horizon, it escapes the constraints of the Israel theorem, and that's where we have to be. And note that the number of parameters is exactly right comparing to the linearized theory. It's exactly the same number of parameters. So this clearly is the mesh between behavior at the origin, behavior at infinity, and this is what I never knew how to do before, but now we understand it. Moreover, so we've seen that the solution at the origin has to go like r squared, and actually, it's good I'm talking about this in the general region of Toronto, because Bob Holdham has done a numerical calculation, which I didn't quite know what to make of before, but now it agrees perfectly with this picture that has emerged. This is a numerical calculation of the full nonlinear field equations, and here is what he obtains. This is a minus log of A and log of B. Of course, in the Schwarzschild solution, A and B are inverses, so out at large R, minus log of A and log B are the same. And as you come in, there's a place where the Schwarzschild horizon would have been. But as you get close to that, things start to break up. And you see that you obtain a different solution near the origin going exactly like R squared. So I think this is pretty robust that we now know the link between the behavior at infinity and the behavior at origin for this class of solutions that has corrections. They do not have a horizon. And in fact, they go into R squared behavior at the origin. okay, so we found this link in the what I call the 2, 2 family of solutions to the higher derivative theories. There's no horizon. they differ strikingly in the inner horizon region from the Schwarzschild solution. Now, there is a curvature singularity at the origin. The radius squared behavior in the space, space, and time, time components will give rise, for example, to a Riemann squared singularity going like r to the minus eighth. But I remind you, this is a time-like singularity, which is not perhaps so different from the singularity in electrodynamics, which is fuzzed out by quantum mechanics, right? So this is not like the Schwarzschild singularity, which is space-like. It's a time-like singularity. Another comment about this is I've been talking about the theory that contains the massive spin 2 ghost. But if you take the limit as the alpha, that's the coefficient of r mu nu squared, to 0, that pushes the ghost out towards infinity. And you still have this basic same behavior. The r plus r squared theory at alpha equals 0 is ghost-free. But it also has the same behavior of these solutions, now I should say this carefully, obtained in the original higher derivative theory. One thing that you can do in r plus r squared is you can introduce an intermediate variable, scalar, perform a conformal rescaling, and then you decide what you want to couple to the rest of the world. So depending on how you couple to the rest of the world, you can get different versions of the spherically symmetric static solution. In this coupling, via the higher derivative theory, coupling by minimal coupling to the rest of the world, you'll obtain the sort of solution I'm telling you about here. Okay, so what about the real world? How much of this do we believe? Well, I've told you about the mathematical points about the just the behavior of the differential equation and its family of solutions. Of course, you have to ask about the issue of stability. This is all limited to spherically symmetric and static configurations. And a collapsing star is not spherically symmetric and is not static. So it could be that it evolves in a different way and doesn't land on this solution that I'm telling you about. Now, what we would like to do would be to study at least the stability of this type of solution I've been telling you about, the no-horizon Yukawa-corrected solution. That's difficult because the closed form of the solution is not known. What one can do, however, is go to Schwarzschild, which we do know explicitly, and you can perform a quasi-normal mode expansion around it and study the stability of Schwarzschild in this higher derivative theory. Now, here I had a conversation with Alexei Starobinsky about this, which was quite illuminating, and he reminded me also that there's not the paper most people know about Brianwit, but another paper where stability was studied of Schwarzschild in the R plus R squared theory. And study of the normal quasi-normal modes around the Schwarzschild solution in the higher derivative theory showed it to be stable. And this perhaps is not surprising because it is equivalent to gravity plus an ordinary positive energy scalar with some peculiar, you know, 1 minus e to the minus phi quantity squared potential, which is why it's attractive to inflation people. But it is in the family of solutions that people consider couplings to ordinary general relativity. Stability considerations that you normally have should apply there. when you include the Weyl squared term, the stability situation is different. And this, again, is unpublished work by Alexei Starobinsky, and I'll come to some other papers. Well, Brianwit and another Korean paper I'll tell you about in a moment. There's a figure of merit here for this issue of stability, including the Weyl squared term, which is here. And this relates to what I mentioned to you about those inequalities that you need to consider in proving the no-hair theorem. I'll call it mu. It's the product of the spin 2 mass of the would-be ghost, the mass of the Schwarzschild mass, if you wish, of the black hole itself or the spherically symmetric solution, divided by Planck mass squared. When this quantity is much greater than 1, let's call this large-ish. Ish because it's not really all that large. If you look at the scale, if we remember that the relevant scale for inflation for the Starobinsky model is 10 to the minus 6 of the Planck mass, you find that this scale where the Schwarzschild mass needs to be of that scale in order to have stability is about 10 to the 6th Planck masses, which is a colony of bacteria or something like that. It's not a very big black hole. But anyway, for large masses larger than that, then one also obtains stability. But for this figure of merit less than or equal to 1, stability is not guaranteed. And this is confirmed by other calculations of quasi-normal modes, again, about the Schwarzschild solution. Brianwit made a suggestion for the R plus Weyl squared theory that, again, there should be stable. He actually gave a number for this mu of 0.44. in order to have stability, and he raised the question of whether an instability could set in for mu less than 0.44, and suggested that there could be a bifurcation of the spherically symmetric solution into two branches, exactly as we have seen. However, he went on, and his calculations seemed to show that there was no instability even for mu less than 0.44. However, this has recently been challenged by a paper just last year by a Korean fellow, Myung, who claimed that Witt did not perform his Schwarzschild stability analysis properly. And indeed, for a non-static analysis, he found that for mu less than something of order 1, he didn't give an explicit break-even point, there would be a Gregory-Laflamme type, something analogous to the Gregory-Laflamme instability in 5 dimensions, which develops here for small mu. So we come to a perspective that, okay, I've been telling you about just the study of the classical solutions. That's all I really know how to do here is to tell you what happened to the solution I didn't understand 30 years ago, the link between infinity and the origin. Now we come to the question of what happens for real black holes. If we take these terms in the action seriously, then for large black holes, they will still be stable, even despite the apparent presence of the spin 2 ghost. But for small black holes, there could be a change of phase in which the Schwarzschild solution becomes unstable, and the most stable solution could be the kind of no horizon solution that I'm telling you about. Okay, well, that's basically the story I wanted to tell you, that I think it indicates that the implications of these higher derivative terms can have rather dramatic consequences for gravitational solutions, particularly for small black holes. So this requires a reconsideration, perhaps, of the whole history of Hawking radiation and so forth when the black hole gets to be very small. So thanks for your attention.
Stability. I think that what I found in the case of cosmology is better that solutions are not stable if you would like to realize this Lyman mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So even in your case, maybe that the time scale of the instability is longer than the lifetime of the universe.
It could be, yeah.
And so I don't think that's, unless one really calculates this lifetime, one should take really seriously this instability. In cosmology, it's really nice to have the transition between the sitter and radiation dominated because it is unstable.
Because you're talking about cosmological solutions. Here I'm considering what happens with an evaporating black hole that gets to be the size of bacteria. They're different considerations. And of course, we know that whatever happens to a black hole accelerates towards the end of its life. I'm suggesting that there can come a point where there's a phase transition. And it changes to a different sort of solution for the small black holes. Yeah, and then, of course, one can consider the whole context in cosmology as you've been doing. That's another story.
It's not a really killing argument to say that it's unstable, then we should not take it seriously, because we don't know exactly the life.
No, I would take the stability and instability issues as evidence of what happens in phase structure of the theory. I think one thing that would be quite interesting to do, but this is maybe hard, is to try to study directly the stability issues of the corrected solution, the no-horizon corrected solution. But the trouble is there, one will only know it, well, you're an expert in this sort of thing. One knows it numerically and one knows the asymptotes. To study the quasi-normal modes abound, that is not easy.
These stability analyses were conducted with respect to linear perturbations of the island.
I believe so, yes. Yeah.
These were for linear.
Yes. Right. Just looking at the eigenvalues of the linear fluctuations with respect to the background, of the Schwarzschild background.
I have some questions about the mechanistic solution. Is there a way in which this solution is inverted becomes now?
Good question. I don't know right off the bat the answer, but yeah, that would be certainly an interesting. Yes, I don't. Well, this is at a point rather than at a surface. Yes. Okay, that's the same. Yeah. This is more similar, I think, to the 1 over r singularity of the Coulomb solution. It's just a gravitational version of that. So one should attempt to do some quantum mechanics around this solution to see what the wave function actually does. Yes. Yes. Right, but it was something that would appear only towards the very end of the evolution of a black hole at the last, you know, femtoseconds or so of its life. This could be where all the bonanza of information gets released to the universe. I don't know.
So maybe I can ask another question. How do you go go into Hawking radiation if you don't have a horizon?
Well, in the case of if you have an evolution where you have a horizon for the first period of the history, then you can conduct more or less standard mm-hmm. analysis. So that's horizon in the sense of an apparent horizon, right? Mm-hmm. Towards the end, what happens at the phase transition is obviously an important question. And then the Hawking radiation, well, one should expect there's going to be some sort of final explosion with this as the remnant.
No further questions. So let's close this part of the session.